Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack. I'm Chris. Today I'll be reading from the January-February Smithsonian special issue titled America at War, the nation's epic, expanding fight against terrorism overseas. We continue today with the conclusion of the last article in the series. This article was written by Jennifer Percy, and it is titled The Priest of Abu Ghraib. Inside Iraq's most notorious prison, an army interrogator came face to face with a shocking truth about the war and himself. The story of Joshua Castile. On October 18, 2004, Castile was scheduled to interrogate a prisoner from Saudi Arabia, who was unusual because he was a self-professed jihadist. By now, Castile had been in Abu Ghraib 5 months and had conducted more than 100 interrogations. This one would change the course of his life. What we know of the interrogation is drawn from Castile's emails, speeches, journals, and other writings. He described the experience with the prisoner as almost mystical, an apotheos. "I was dumbstruck," he wrote in a letter home to his mother. "I left praising Christ and thanking God for this enemy." Castile began the interrogation with customary questions. Where are the access points into Iraq from Syria and Saudi Arabia? When did you arrive here? What are your intentions here in Iraq? Then Castile asked the jihadist why he had come to Iraq to kill. The jihadist looked at Castile, but didn't answer. Instead, he asked the same of him. Why did you come to Iraq to kill? It was a fair question. It was the question that had haunted him ever since he had arrived, and though he didn't admit it, Castile was far more afraid of killing than being killed. Castile's left hand was in his pocket, gripping the crucifix on his rosary. The prisoner counted prayer beads in his right hand. "If there were a knife on the table," Castile asked, "would you pick it up and kill me?" "I will have to think about it," the prisoner said. "What is there to think about?" "Maybe I will pick it up and I will kill you. Maybe I will wait." Against protocol, Castile began to speak to the prisoner about the teachings of Christ. He told him that the violence condoned by Islam was not the only path in life. Christ had taught another way. The jihadist responded that vengeance was his right, since the Americans were an invading army on Arab lands. "You claim to be a Christian," he said, "and yet you don't follow Christ to pray for those who prosecute you or pray for your enemies. Your Lord, our prophet Isa, tells you to turn the other cheek, to love those who hate you. Why do you not do this?" Castile had spent his whole life preaching the word of Christ, and now his words were being returned to him by a jihadist in a gentle, evangelical tone. Every challenge to the prisoner came back as a challenge to himself. It was clear the jihadist had peace because of his belief in Islam. He told Castile that if he was put in prison and never released, he would be okay with that, because he was acting justly, in accordance with his faith. Did Castile have that same kind of peace? "What is terrifying is that the jihadist generally wanted my conversation," Castile wrote afterward, "and I felt him actually care for me, desire for my good." Castile's job as an interrogator faded to the periphery. Finally, he succumbed. "You're right," he said to the jihadist's gentle admonishments. To his parents afterward, Castile wrote, "I confessed to him my sins and I asked him to look at his own." I am certain that this interrogation was not doctrinal by army standards. Pardon my bluntness, but to hell with the army and their doctrines. Today was a moment when life mattered. "After the interrogation," he wrote, "I left and I prayed I would be given the chance to see him one day in the future when I could say, I left that world behind me. So can you." Castile walked out of the interrogation room and told his superiors that if they wanted to continue interrogating this man, it would have to be done by someone else. He went on scheduled leave to Qatar, where he shot off emails to family and friends. "So I just experienced why it is I'm here in Iraq," he began on one email. "Other than all the struggles I've been wrestling with, I just met my reason, a young foreign jihadist who said he might kill me if he had the chance. That is, as long as I am a U.S. soldier in Muslim lands. The gospel came out of his mouth unwittingly while trying to convert me to Islam. It was beautiful. It was soon clear to Castile what he had to do. He would apply for an honorable discharge as a conscientious objector, which meant he'd have to prove not that he simply opposed the war in Iraq, but that he had a firm, fixed, and sincere objection to participation in war of any form, or the bearing of arms, by reason of religious training and belief. Not everyone was supportive. He had already been exchanging long, anguished emails full of competing interpretations of scripture with his father, who, as a devoted Christian conservative, couldn't understand his son's righteous turn against the war. Castile's friend, Miguel Browser, a Navy petty officer he had met at the Language Institute in Monterey, told me that he thought Castile's CO nonsense, as he put it, was a cop-out at first. He wrote to Castile, "If you're going to be a CO, take off your uniform, run off into the desert, into Baghdad, and join the church there and live your life." Father Martin responded even more harshly, "Joshua, please refrain from sending me any more examples of the narcissistic personality. The degree of your present self-absorption is indicative of a spiritual sickness that issues forth into the betrayal of many. And besides, I am presently trying to help soldiers and sailors whose obedience and humility reveal much more of Jesus to me than your psychic journey through cloud cuckoo land." Christ had been misunderstood too. When Castile returned to Abu Ghraib, he told his commander he could no longer serve in the army. He believed his job as a soldier and interrogator contradicted his obligations as a Christian. It had been 2 weeks since his encounter with the jihadist. To Castile's shock, his commander was encouraging. "He totally supports me," Castile wrote to his friend Jacob Flohr in manic excitement. "He told me he thought I was one of the best interrogators under his command, that he very much appreciated the way I have handled my duties in light of my ethical dilemmas, that he has been nothing but impressed with my nobility, leadership, and maturity. Good thing he doesn't read my tempestuous emails. And that I am an interrogator with the greatest knowledge of Arabs, the greatest sensitivity and creativity, outright." Needless to say, I was pretty dumbstruck. During a hearing connected to his application, Castile said, "To take another's life is the quintessential statement of divine judgment and faithfulness toward the possibility of reconciliation and redemption. I wish to end the delusion that good is gained by evil means, or that even maintaining my own economic and physical security is something to be defended by means of violence. I believe that idea to be a lie." While Castile waited for approval, the army gave him something to do outside of the interrogation room. He was given trash duty, which meant he helped to pour jet fuel onto the waste in a different pit from the one burning day and night near his sleeping quarters. The military burned paint and plastic and batteries and ordnance. It burned styrofoam, petroleum, soda cans, medical waste, human limbs. For weeks, Castile worked right on the edge of the pit, making sure the fire didn't spread. He returned to Iowa January 2005. In May, he was honorably discharged as a conscientious objector, one of the few service members to apply for and receive approval in the early years of the Iraq War. It was perhaps the only decision he made with absolute clarity in Iraq. Castile described coming home as like stepping into the twilight zone. His second day back, his sister Rebecca brought him to the mall in Cedar Rapids to buy him a leather jacket, a late Christmas present. He slipped the jacket over his arms and looked into the mirror. 2 days earlier, I'd been in Kuwait, toting an M16. 3 weeks before that, in Iraq, strapped in body armor and aiming that same M16 at little boys, he wrote to a friend. I don't know how to go on from flask vest and assault rifles to fashion cycle jackets. He suffered from depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. Strangely, he missed the clarity of war. Everything over there came down to life and death. Many nights he drank. He had a lot of turmoil going on at the time, says Roth. He needed redemption, to turn over a new leaf. That winter, Castile and Flohr, who had traveled to Iraq with a Christian peace organization known as the International Center of Reconciliation, met up with Roth and Claire to tour the Pacific Northwest and give speeches about their experiences in Iraq. On the cold Oregon coast, Castile stripped naked to baptize himself in the ocean. He was just that kind of passionate, unpredictable person, Roth says. He felt much better after that catharsis, and it seemed to sharpen his resolve. Castile became involved with the nonprofit organizations Iraq Veterans Against the War and the Catholic Peace Fellowship, which supports active military members and veterans who are struggling, as the group puts it, with the contradiction between their personal participation in the war and their consciences. In 2006, Castile enrolled in the writing program at the University of Iowa, where he wrote several plays about the dilemmas of soldiers at Abu Ghraib. In Returns, the protagonist is an interrogator named James who, Castile wrote in the play's introduction, suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder and is haunted by the faces of men he interrogated. A man of faith, James is nicknamed Priest by his army buddies, which he resents for the holiness it implies and wishes he still possessed. The play premiered in 2007 in Iowa City with Castile in the lead role. Roth attended the opening and says he didn't know just how tormented Castile was until he saw the play. It featured so much screaming that if you were in the front row, you'd be wearing his spit, he told me. But it all came down to the last phrase, where it was just him under a spotlight, turning the typical post-tour of duty question back on the audience. What was it like? That sent chills down my spine. It was like asking the audience, what was this play full of screaming and crying like for you? It was confrontational, of course. It was also a critique of the absurdity of asking a war vet such a casual question. It was then that I knew I didn't ever want to ask him that question because it could never be answered. That well was just too deep and dark. In Iraq, Castile had started to cough up a thick black mucus. Lots of other soldiers were doing it too. It's no big deal, they said, just Iraqi crud. Besides, Castile had suffered from allergies since he was a child, and Abu Ghraib was just full of dust and sand and smoke. Now back in the States, Castile was often congested and coughing. Doctors at the Veterans Affairs hospitals told him he had asthma. He walked out with a prescription for albuterol, a common asthma medication. When he returned, they prescribed more inhalers. Over the next few years, Castile wrote and traveled widely, lecturing about his experiences across the United States and in England, Ireland, Sweden, and South Korea. He was invited to the Vatican to speak to officials about the church's role in advocating nonviolence. And a photograph of Castile shaking hands with Pope Benedict XVI now hangs in the offices at the Catholic Peace Fellowship in South Bend, Indiana. During a 2009 lecture at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania, Castile reminded the audience that Christians make up the vast majority of uninformed American troops. I have a simple message today as we approach the 6th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, he said. If Christians wish to lessen the spread of evil throughout the world, they need only to refrain from doing it. The next year, after enrolling in divinity school in Chicago and getting a job teaching a graduate writing workshop, Castile began experiencing terrible back pain. He visited the chiropractor, but nothing helped. At home in Iowa, his mother drove him to the VA. The doctors diagnosed bronchitis. They sent him home. On Halloween, he coughed so hard something snapped in his back. At the emergency room, the doctors took x-rays for the first time and discovered a mess of tumors in his lungs. The next morning, Castile called Christy and told her she needed to come to the hospital. He didn't tell her that the doctor said it was probably cancer, because he didn't want her worrying during the drive. She was frantic. In the waiting room, she held a pamphlet she had tossed into her purse on her way out and read the same line over and over, something about protecting us from evil, from the onslaught of the enemy. Then the doctors walked in and announced that her 31-year-old son had stage 4 adrenocarcinoma, cancer of the lungs. They said this was rarely found in otherwise healthy young men. Mostly it affects geriatric patients and Asian women. Joshua had tumors in his lungs, liver, and spine. Later it would spread to his arms, legs, and finally his brain. Christy fell forward onto the floor and started sobbing. She cried so hard the maintenance man dropped his tools and ran over to comfort her. Joshua came out. "Do you know?" she asked him. He said he knew. "But I don't think I'm done," he said. "I have too much to do." He wanted to finish his PhD. He wanted to start a magazine and a film company. He had a memoir to finish. He thought he might want to have a family or enter the priesthood. He hadn't given up that dream. "I'm not yet going to die. I'm not going to die because I haven't made it as a priest yet, he told himself. Castile visited a lot of specialists. The pain was so bad, he slept an hour at a time. He had spinal surgery, radiation therapy, chemo. His hair fell out. Fall turned to winter, then spring, then summer, and not 20 minutes passed without pain. He used a cane to walk. People visited him and prayed. Castile started to wonder if he was being punished or tested by God for what the Americans had done in Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of innocents killed. Iraq torn apart, close to a decade after the invasion. The wider region was destabilized and only getting worse. Then a friend stopped by to visit, a woman whose father had suffered most of his adult life from exposure to Agent Orange. Do you think maybe the cancer has anything to do with Iraq? She asked. His friend told him respiratory illnesses were being diagnosed in many soldiers returning from the war, and some doctors were connecting them back to the burn pits. The condition was called Iraq-Afghanistan War Lung Injury. Some families of veterans had started a registry to document those affected and were talking about lawsuits. The burn pits were used on U.S. military bases throughout Iraq and Afghanistan to get rid of waste, even though the incinerators, safer mechanisms for disposing of the waste, often sat unused. Castile had slept 100 yards away from an enormous burn pit, and in his final weeks he had manned a second one. The connection had never occurred to him. He had never used a mask when he worked. His concerns had been metaphysical. In 2011, his muscles spasmed from his waist up. Castile was in agony, lips locked between clenched teeth. At the hospital, Christy lifted her son and walked him around like a marionette because the nurses wouldn't help. She had to scream at a nurse in the hallway to persuade her to give Castile a shot for the pain. Christy took Castile home to Cedar Rapids in December. 2 weeks later, he had a seizure so strong the vertebrae in his spine collapsed. He went back to the hospital, but Castile believed he had been blessed with a mysterious grace from the very beginning. I'll suffer, he said, and then I'll get better. He was determined to continue his work. He kept teaching and giving speeches as long as he could. He appeared in a PBS documentary called Soldiers of Conscience. I feel a sense of relief that I get to share in the suffering of the Iraqi people, he told his friends and family, because the Americans burn toxins in their fields and on their earth. In a certain sense, it's an opportunity to climb up on the cross with them. The war was a path for him to become more like Christ. A year or two earlier, Castile had written in his journal about the time he asked his mother, "When you look down the road of my life, what do you see me doing?" "I think you're going to follow in the footsteps of Christ," she replied. "Me too," he told her. In early 2012, Castile traveled with his mother to New York, where he would take part in a clinical trial of an experimental cancer drug. They lived at a housing center for cancer patients and their families in Midtown Manhattan called Hope Lodge. For a while, Castile was able to manage the stairs to the subway, but the cancer mutated and spread. When a nurse told him it was time for palliative care, he said he didn't like the word palliative, which he knew came from the Latin for to cover or cloak, disguising the inevitable. Soon Castile's spine crumbled. He became emaciated. Movement was so excruciating that his eyes rolled back in his head. His mother and sisters took turns holding his arms above his head for hours, hoping it would relieve the pain. One Saturday, on the way to the hospital, Christy passed a church with a statue that made her pause. It was the limp body of Christ just after he had been pulled from the cross. That statue looks just like Joshua, she thought. Christy walked to the hospital. She told her son how much she loved him, how he had been the joy of her life, that she could never have asked for a better son. I think at that moment I knew what was coming, Christy said. In the days that followed, he weakened to the point of no recovery. One afternoon, Castile started to have a hard time breathing. Christy fled to the bathroom. She couldn't bear it. Then she began to think about Mary, how it must have been for her when Jesus was going to die and returned. Christy had a necklace Joshua had given her with a blue heart, which to her symbolized Mary. In the bathroom, God told her, "Don't desert him now. This is his walk up the hill." He was climbing up on the cross. When Joshua was near the end, that was the image that God brought to me, Christy said. We were walking up the hill together. It happened at 3:30 p.m. on a Saturday. I know that to follow Christ is to suffer, Christy said shortly after Joshua died. And when I'm in my sound mind, and not in desperate pain and loneliness that comes much more often than I wanted to, I can genuinely say that this suffering is a small price to pay to have had my son for 32 years. After her son died, Christy established the Joshua Castile Foundation, which raises awareness about Iraqis and veterans in need of help, in particular, those affected by the burn pits. More than 10,000 veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have filed medical claims connected to the pits, and the Department of Veteran Affairs have acknowledged that burn pit exposure is related to at least 2,200 of the cases. Christie's foundation also works with a Catholic community center in Alliance, Ohio, named the Joshua Castile Home. Near the end of his life, Castile told his friends and family that he had found peace. He found it in spite of his illness, in spite of the war, in spite of the world's imperfection, and because he hoped others would keep fighting for peace once he was gone. I have been given back a hope I remember from childhood, he wrote to them, but which has been chastened by suffering and baptized by a voluntary love. And I am a happier man. We'll end with this short article written by Terence Monmany, titled Military Intelligence. It's no secret that many Americans are fatigued by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now it's clear for the first time that the troops are too, according to a new poll conducted by Smithsonian with two partners, the Defense Department publication Stars and Stripes and the Schar School at George Mason University. 17 years after the U.S.-led military invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, more than 80% of the 1,031 service members and veterans surveyed agreed with the statement that the occupations have been going on too long. As far as we know, the survey was the first one to pose that question to current and former service members. Their frustration is significant because they also voiced strong support for the war on terror generally, with 83% saying it should continue. On the home front, 65% of responders backed the move by President Trump to deploy armed forces at the U.S. border with Mexico to prevent illegal immigration. At the same time, the great majority appeared to take a dim view of the administration's proposal to deport non-citizen service members or their families. The military community was more in step with the administration's proposed policy, currently being challenged in court, to ban transgender people in the armed services. Overall, only 39% of respondents said transgender people should be allowed to serve. In particular, though, female and millennial respondents were more in favor of transgender troops than the survey population as a whole, with more than 50% expressing support. Taken together, the findings suggest that military life poses special difficulties for women, despite their eagerness to serve. About 2/3 of current and former female service members said they had experienced sexual discrimination while in the military. The same proportion said they had experienced sexual harassment or assault. That level of mistreatment is twice as high as other recent studies have reported. Perhaps women subjected to such duress were more likely than other women to respond to the survey invitation. As for males, only 6% reported experiencing sexual discrimination, harassment, or assault. Some answers depended on the age of the survey taker. Compared with millennials, the greatest generation was twice as supportive of sending troops to the border, half as supportive of transgender troops, far more likely to say the military prepared them for later life, and about 1/7 as likely to relax by playing first-person shooter video games. In the poll conducted over the 2018 Veterans Day holiday, more than 23,000 digital subscribers to Stars and Stripes news services worldwide received an email invitation to participate anonymously in an online opinion survey about military policy and conditions in the armed services. The respondents were 109 active duty service members and 922 veterans from all branches of the armed services, including officers as well as enlisted personnel. Among them were 76 women. The analysis excluded 676 other respondents who were not current or former service members. a research team led by Denton Diagle, a political scientist at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government, designed the poll and performed the statistical analysis of results. Overall, the margin of error was plus or minus 3%, but the figure was higher for smaller subsamples. For results limited to female respondents, the margin of error was only about 11%. This does conclude the special double issue of Smithsonian titled America at War, the nation's epic, expanding fight against terrorism overseas. We do have time for a little lighter topic. Ask Smithsonian. You've got questions. We've got experts. First question, why are starfish shaped like stars? Scientists can't pinpoint exactly why starfish evolved to have radial symmetry, with arms, usually five, but as many as 40 in some species, growing from a central axis. However, Dave Pawson, senior scientist at the National Museum of Natural History, notes that the arrangement confers certain advantages on the animals, which lacking a backbone aren't technically fish. At the tip of each arm is an eye that can detect changes in light intensity, and on the bottom are tubed feet that enable it to move in any direction. Several species of starfish can regenerate an arm lost to a predator or an accident, and a few can even regenerate a new central disc from a severed arm, as long as a fragment of the disc remains with the arm. Second question, why were teacher colleges called normal schools? Thank France, the phrase is derived from École Normale, which was used for institutions designed to instill standards of curriculum in teachers-to-be, says Debbie Schaefer-Jacobs, associate curator in the Division of Cultural and Community Life at the National Museum of American History. America's first state-sponsored normal school opened in Massachusetts in 1839 at the urging of public education champion Horace Mann. It is now Framingham State University. More arose through the mid-19th century in parallel with the development of public schools, then called common schools. By the 1930s, however, most normal schools were calling themselves teachers' colleges. Third question. The night skies of the northern and southern hemispheres have different constellations. Can you see that difference as soon as you cross the equator? No, says Rebecca Lundgren, an astronomy educator at the National Air and Space Museum. The differences become more apparent as you get farther from the equator, or closer to the North or South Pole. Depending on the time of year or your latitude, you can still see many of the same constellations in either hemisphere. At the equator, you can see all parts of the sky if you're patient. The Southern Cross and the North Star will be really low on the horizon and hard, but not impossible to spot. Last question. I have heard that all kinds of artists used to live at Carnegie Hall. Is that true? It is. Shortly after the hall was built in 1891, two towers containing 170 rental studios were added. They provided the hall with an additional source of income and artists a place to live and work. Through the 20th century, the residents made up a remarkable, vibrant community of musicians, dancers, and painters, says Jennifer Coleman Brockie, a reference librarian at the Copper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum. Among the better-known tenants were Leonard Bernstein, Marlon Brando, and the fashion photographer Bill Cunningham. The last renters were evicted in 2010 as the Carnegie Hall Corporation moved to renovate the towers into spaces for archival storage, teaching, and rehearsal. Well, that's all the time we have for today on the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the January-February edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. Thanks for listening to Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. So long until next time.